It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pittsburgh Bureau of Police has reinstituted training for new recruits when they interact with unhoused residents and the impact that involvement with law enforcement has on folks who are housing insecure. Sergeant Colleen Bristow oversees the Housing Academy program, which actually started in November of 2019. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Sergeant, the city's budget for 2021 actually limited the number of incoming officers. How many recruits had received the training prior to the halt due to the pandemic, and how many are receiving it currently?
We piloted this, like you said, in November of 2019. We had 28 recruits at that time. Of course, that's when in-person was going on. Due to the pandemic, we had to create the new normal of police training as well. This year, we had 32 recruits run through it virtually.
I understand that about one in four of the recruits said they had never had a conversation with a person experiencing homelessness. Is that part of the training? How do you talk with an unhoused resident of Pittsburgh?
Yeah, that's actually something that we talk about. We talk about that. We talk about weapons that people may have on them. Our officers are going to be going into camps. And if someone goes into something that they don't understand what they're going into, their guard becomes up. They become, you know, afraid. If we don't prepare them and have them ready and inoculated to that, then, you know, they may overreact. They may have a stress reaction, things like that. So we want them, they see images of it. They hear from Dan Palka from AHN, who does a fantastic job of explaining, you know, that each person they're encountering has a unique story. You know, here are some of the common things you're going to see, you're going to smell. You know, like I said before, they may have weapons on them. Here's why. They're going to have a natural guard up to you. Here's why. You know, it's not a personal offense towards you.
Right. You mentioned AHN. So how did you develop the training? Did you actually seek out any advice from people who are experiencing homelessness?
So the training was actually suggested to us from the Office of Community Health and Safety Manager, Laura Dragowski. She's a visionary that works on the Homeless Advisory Committee with the City of Pittsburgh. She has a great working relationship with AHN Dan Palka, who used to formerly be with Operation Safety Net. And then she had spoke with officers that had actually talked about their experience of first time being in homeless camps. And Officer Wisner of Zone 2 said, you know, this would be great to put into the academy. She had attended a substance use disorder training that I had hosted here, and we kind of realized this was a natural fit with almost the two things together. Mm-hmm. And then we bring in a community leader and advocate that has lived experience.
So the recruits are learning that some of our unhoused neighbors have faced other challenges in addition to being without shelter. You mentioned substance use and maybe some other issues, challenges as well.
Yes, yes. We definitely talk about that. And we talk about harm reduction, how our encounters can actually like remove them from housing lists. And, you know, what happens when we arrest them and things like that? Like, what are the effects of what we create as law enforcement?
So the officers in training, are they being instructed to contact support services if they determine there might be an immediate need to call in, you know, a professional, a social service worker who can better assist on the spot?
Absolutely. Yes, that's a big thing that we cover, you know, we go over here. We wish that we had the most great systems that we could automatically have them come to, but that's where Dan Palka comes in. Dan Palka presents them with what we actually really have in real time now. We have the Big Berg app, and AHN has the outreach team that we're using that's exploring the co-responder model, and we're exploring diversion. But he gives them the realistic on here's what you have, here's what you have now, and here's what you can do. Is it necessarily best practice yet? No, it's not, you know. But we're working on getting there, and here's what we have now.
What would you like to see the next step for these quick services, these quick responses?
That's exactly what I would love to see, the quick responses, so that we can get the citizens the care that they need and the appropriate services, because most of the time they are not law enforcement. Mm-hmm. But we've kind of exacerbated all other options.
About this homeless academy, Public Safety Director Wendell Hisrick said, quote, "This is a continuation of police's years-long focus on building bridges with all communities in Pittsburgh. The training is for the new recruits." I mean, that's a very small portion of the about 900 city police officers. Do you think that all officers should receive this training? Would they benefit from it?
A version of this training, yes. Not the direct same one, because we also do, at the Training Academy, we actually do the in-service training for our officers every year. And there's a difference between, you know, introducing someone to something and someone that's already been out there experiencing it.
A version of it. I mean, they might have experienced it, but their response to it could change with additional training. What are you saying here?
So it'd be a similar training to it, but you would remove the stuff of people that have never had encounters, because you're trying to teach someone something that they've never experienced, versus teaching someone that's experienced something already. So you could actually take that aspect out of it. But the similar, the humanizing, the improved interactions, the meaningful connections, the discretion, yes, that part could all stay in it, but the procedural part would be gone.
Do you see that happening, though, for the veteran officers?
Yeah, we would absolutely love to. Because of the pandemic, we have had to scale back on in-service training and try to do things as virtually as we can. Now that we've seen that we could do this virtual, I absolutely think it has a place that we can explore while we're still in the pandemic.
Finally, Sergeant, how will you measure the success of your program for the new recruits?
So I love to reach out to people after the fact when they've gone through these things and they have now been a patrol officer, and talk to them about, how did this work for you? What would you hope that we would have put in there? What did we miss? What could you have used more of? Luckily, I have the opportunity to still go out on to patrol if we're responding to 911 calls. So it gives us that opportunity to have those engagements and seek input, and also makes the officers feel like they have a voice in their training. And I think that's really important.
Sergeant Colleen Bristow oversees the Homeless Academy for the new Pittsburgh police recruits to have better interactions with those experiencing housing insecurity in Pittsburgh. Sergeant, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Mary Lee Williams. The books we read as children hold a special place in our hearts, transporting us to distant lands and helping readers sort through the complexities of growing up. This Sunday, Pittsburgh Arts and Lectures will host a conversation with an author who crafts these journeys for young readers. Pam Munoz-Ryan has written more than 40 books. Her book Echo garnered critical acclaim, and her most recent novel, Mañana Land, takes readers on a journey with a young boy named Max. Max's family holds many secrets about his mother's disappearance and about their history as guardians. Pam, thanks so much for chatting with me.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
What role does the feeling of belonging play in your books? I'm thinking specifically within Echo and Mañana Land.
Belonging to a family or a community is a tether. And it's a way of feeling grounded and connected and of knowing who you are and where you fit into the world. And I think for adolescents or young readers, this is a universal feeling, especially as they get close to their teen years. In Mañana Land, my character Max lives with a father and grandfather and others who love him in a protective community. So his sense of belonging seems intact. But that sense of belonging also goes hand in hand with a sense of security. And of course, the opposite, not belonging, goes hand in hand with insecurity and doubt and uncertainty. So as a writer, I'm often putting my characters in situations where they go from one situation of maybe feeling very secure to the opposite situation of having their life unravel and then having to deal with that. In my novel, Echo, as well as in Mañana Land, all the characters start out secure in their immediate environment. But as their stories progress, their lives convolute, and everything they've known to be safe and true upends. And they begin to question who they are, what they believe in, and how and where they belong.
So conversely, what role does not belonging and not conforming play in your books?
Well, I think that issue of not conforming is also something that adolescents face. You know, fitting in all aspects of your life is a pretty daunting task. And I think that for my characters, I want to show a character that has a broad range of emotional traits. I want to show that they sometimes can be confident and other times can be extremely insecure. I want them to have a wide breadth of characteristics. So I think that what happens is that the not belonging becomes an obstacle, but it also becomes a challenge. And I guess as the writer, that's what I want to portray for my characters, is that that feeling of not fitting in becomes a challenge instead of something that cannot be overcome.
In Manana Land, you touch on very serious topics, very relevant to our time. And one kind of big question that I think comes up is, are you willing to put yourself at risk for someone, a stranger, who is experiencing injustice? Did you think this book would be so relevant to our time?
Well, I'm not sure that when I write any of my books that I'm conscious of, you know, how it will be relative when it finally publishes, because that's often years away. But let me back up by saying I began this book 5 years ago when I finished Echo. So the culture of not helping or imprisoning those who run from injustice had not received the notoriety that it has in the last few years. Did I think Manana Land would be relevant? I think the answer to that really in my heart is yes, because it is a never-ending story of people fleeing oppression from another country or from their own neighborhood or from their own home. And I think that is why the story is deliberately not set in a particular year, because it happened decades ago. It is happening now all over the world, and it is likely to continue in the tomorrows to come, unfortunately.
Going to the book that was published prior to Manana Land, Echo follows four different stories, all in different times, different cultures, different places. What was your research process like?
The research is a deep dive. You know, it's triggered by something that I think would be interesting to look into. And I began at a small historical society in Lemon Grove, California, where I thought I was researching a completely separate idea. And that was there that I discovered the impetus for Echo. I saw a small picture from 1930s of a small group of children sitting on the steps of a country school. And they were each holding a small harmonica. And I was intrigued, and I asked the docent about it. And she said, oh, you know, that's not part of the research that you're looking for. But just so you know, that was our little elementary school harmonica band. And, you know, back in the 20s and 30s when during the big harmonica band movement in the United States. And I said, you know, what? And she said, oh, yeah, all the elementary schools had them. Well, I spent the afternoon there gathering all the research for what I thought was going to be my next book. And as I drove home, I was just so intrigued by what she had said. And I came home and started doing research and started looking up harmonica bands in America and was, you know, so intrigued by the fact that there were over 2,000 harmonica bands in the United States during that period of time. One thing led to another, and actually led me to Philadelphia and Albert Hoxie's Philadelphia Harmonica Band of Wizards. And I began to think immediately, what if one, you know, I already had the premise for two stories, a young girl in Lemon Grove, California, on the steps of that little country school, and then a young boy in Philadelphia in Hoxie's band, and the whole premise started forming about maybe one harmonica that had traveled between them, but I needed another story. I began to research the Hohner Harmonica Company. In the course of researching, they invited me to Trossingen, Germany, to research at their harmonica factory and museum. And it was there that I discovered that during 1933, young boy apprentices worked in the factory. So there was a third character. And so the research just becomes, you know, dots on a path very often. It's I'm not quite sure how to explain it, but, you know, it's primary sources. It's a lot of reading. It's a lot of curiosity. And as I said before, it's a very deep dive.
So you probably know more about harmonicas than the average person at this point.
Absolutely. And, you know, the other thing about research is because the book begins in Trossingen, Germany in 1933, when Hitler becomes chancellor, to write about that time period, I had to go back and read about the end of World War I and the Treaty of Versailles and Hitler's book that he wrote, you know, Mein Kampf. And I had to understand the psychology and what led up to those early years when he first became dictator. So the research just becomes very broad and very deep.
So you dedicate Manana Land to your mother, saying, quote, "for protecting me beyond measure," end quote. Protecting, that's a pretty big theme in Manana Land. So what does protection mean to you?
First of all, I should preface this by saying that when I was 12 years old, my mother came to me and asked me if I remembered my biological father. I didn't. He was never discussed in any circles in my presence. Nothing bad, nothing good, nothing at all. I had a wonderful stepfather who raised me, who was loving and kind. And so I never felt as if I had been missing something. But I knew. I did know about my biological father. It was just never discussed. So this was a very strange sensation growing up, the knowing but the not knowing and the not acknowledging. So there was much more to my family history than anyone ever admitted, and things that no one would ever talk about. I never knew that there was always the threat that I could be snatched away from my family, or that there had been attempts when I was too young to remember. So I channeled all those feelings and anxiety to write about Max in Manana Land. And like Max, I had vigilant guardians protecting me from danger. So I didn't replicate exactly the circumstances from my own life, but I drew upon those feelings and emotions from that experience. So protection, I think, is something that we all strive for, this feeling of safety for ourselves and our loved ones. And I think it's a life without fear or repression, and it's the ability to live a life accepted for who you are and with a feeling of worthiness. And so I look back on my own personal experience and the great lengths that my mother and her family went to protect me from someone who was dangerous. And I think as a writer, that's how I approached the protection issue in Manana Land.
Pam Munoz-Ryan is a children's author. She's written many books, including Echo, and her most recent is Manana Land. She'll be speaking this Sunday at 2:30 p.m. as part of the Pittsburgh Arts and Lecture Words and Picture Series. Pam, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you for having me.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Lara Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.